Good morning, good day, guten Tag. Welcome to a special program of the Frankfurt Book Fair 2013 presented by the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center. My name is Christopher Keneally. If you are tweeting, the hashtag for our session today is hashtag CCC Open Access. When it comes to pop stars and politicians, we know when their time has come. For a pop star, a recording goes platinum. For a politician, her validation will come with a victory at the polls. In scholarly and scientific publishing, the call often comes in the middle of the night. Stockholm is on the line, and a Nobel Prize is to be awarded. For Randy Scheckman, a cell biologist at the University of California, Berkeley, the phone rang on Monday morning, this past Monday morning, at 1:45. He would have been asleep anyway, but Scheckman was especially exhausted after returning home from a long meeting in Frankfurt. Along with Germany's Thomas Sudhoff and another American, James Rothman, Professor Scheckman had won the 2013 Nobel Prize for Medicine or Physiology for research into how the cell organizes its transport system. For us here, though, there is another accomplishment worth noting. Scheckman is editor-in-chief of eLife, a peer-reviewed open-access scientific journal for the biomedical and life sciences that debuted only a year ago. So when we say that open access is the force remaking scholarly publishing, we aren't kidding. Throughout 2013, indeed, open access, OA, has made many headlines. Leading the way are influential research funders who have mandated paradigm shifts in publishing practices that are sparking dramatic retooling of long-standing business models. As scholarly and scientific publishers, many of them here joining us today, test new business models, the focus particularly is on the collection of article processing charges. Funders require compliance with mandates, authors look for a complete and rewarding user experience, and publishers want efficiency and flexibility. The pace of transformation is accelerating, and demand for solutions is mounting. When authors pay, what should publishers expect to face? Joining me now for the next hour to take on these questions, and some of yours as well, is a distinguished panel that I'm very delighted to introduce to you. And joining me from the far end here is Robert Kiley. Robert, welcome. Robert Kiley is head of digital services at the Wellcome Library. He is responsible for developing and implementing a strategy to deliver electronic services to the library's users, both in person and remote. And a key element of his current role is to develop the infrastructure to support the Wellcome Library's strategy to provide free online universal access to its unique and important collections. He's also taking a leading role in the implementation of the Trust's open access policy. To his left is Ellen Collins. Ellen's welcome.
Thank you.
Ellen's is a research consultant at the Research Information Network based in the UK, where she has initiated, developed, and managed projects for clients including academic publishers, librarians, funders, and policymakers. She is also lead researcher on Open UK, a collaborative research project to explore open access scholarly monograph publishing. To her left is Karen Hawkins. Karen, welcome. Good morning. Karen is Director of Product Management at IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. Karen and her team manage a diversified portfolio of information products, online and in print. She has served as IEEE Director of Marketing and Executive Director at IEEE Press. And finally, joining me to my right is Rob Johnson. Rob, nice to see you.
Good morning, Chris.
Rob is founder and director of Research Consulting, providing research management service to the higher education, healthcare, and academic publishing sectors. He previously served as head of research operations at the University of Nottingham, with responsibility for oversight of that university's £400 million portfolio on research projects. I want to start with Robert Kiley. Robert, welcome again. And I have to ask you, as one of the principal supporters of eLife, along with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and the Max Planck Society, are you basking in the reflected glow of Randy Scheckman's award? But more to the point, what does it mean to have someone of his caliber and his stature associated with open access?
Okay, yes. Obviously, we are basking in the reflected glory of Randy. Personally, it was really... I've been so pleased with the way eLife has taken off. It was an idea I had back in about two or three years ago that we needed to try and do something at a... try and push the open access at a very, very top tier, and that's what we hope eLife will do. Obviously, for the open access movement generally, it helps to demonstrate beyond doubt that open access and high quality can be natural bedfellows. And in a week which we saw the publication of the so-called science scam, where various articles, you know, low-quality articles were accepted for publication in low-quality journals, that myth again, that open access low quality was put to the fore again, a myth completely. But the fact that, you know, eLife and Randy are demonstrating that high quality and open access are very natural bedfellows.
Right. Well, that obviously, that story of the sting did make some headlines, but there have been some other headlines associated with open access throughout this year. And perhaps for the audience, you should review one of the important points. In April, you instituted a mandate, a very strict mandate, around open access for researchers who receive funding from Wellcome Trust, and that's part of a larger story going on in the UK.
That's true. So the Wellcome Trust has had an open access policy for many years, probably for too many years, since about 2005. But in the summer of last year, or actually in the spring of this year, we actually tightened that mandate in a number of ways, the most significant of which was a requirement that when the Wellcome Trust, through its grantees, pays an open access fee, we require that article to be licensed in a very permissive way using the Creative Commons Attribution License.
The so-called Gold Road.
The so-called Gold Road, and with a particular license. But obviously the UK, there's an awful lot going on in the UK, really led predominantly by the development of the Research Council's open access policy, which also came into the relaunch of that came into effect in April this year. And the centre point to that was a clear direction that the Research Council's funded research should be made open access, and preferred route for that was the gold route.
Right. And open access, as you say, isn't entirely new, but it certainly is more prominent than ever. And it's even apparent here at the Frankfurt Book Fair. We see a number of publishers associated with the open access model. Again, just for the audience to get a sense of the importance of all of this, do you have some numbers on the size, how many articles are we talking about per year?
Well, I think with open access numbers, it's almost like pick a number out of the hat. Because one thing it is difficult to do, and that's measure accurately. I think what we can see is sort of research by people like Bjork has shown a huge growth from a tiny low base of in around the year 2000 of about 800 gold articles through to about by 2011 it's about 130,000-140,000. So we've seen a huge growth in that. We've also seen the development of what we call pure open access journals, so the development of journals like PLOS One. PLOS One is now obviously the biggest journal on the planet. I think in 2013, it's scheduled to publish about 30,000 articles on its own. And in addition to that, what we've seen virtually all of the existing subscription publishers either introduce pure open access journals. I believe Elsevier have got a stable of about 40 titles now. But probably more importantly, they've developed a hybrid open access option. So across virtually all of their subscription journals, there's now an option to publish open access. And to give you a sense of scale of like the Wellcome Trust, if we look at the last year of data, the single most popular journal used by Wellcome Trust authors was PLOS One, and it published about 8 or 9% of trust-funded research.
Okay. Well, is that trust-funded research, is that a significant cost to researchers to pay for open access articles?
So obviously there are costs, and we've always been very upfront in recognizing that. Our sort of mantra, and if I had a pound for every time I said this, I could have retired many, many years ago, but the mantra is that dissemination costs are research costs. So they are real costs. The sums we've done would sort of suggest that if all the research we made open access, if all the research we published was made open access using the standard APC we're currently seeing, and I think there is pressure to reduce that APC, but notwithstanding that, we would reckon that it would cost around 10 or so million pounds for our research made open access, which equates to about 1.5% of the research spend. But I suspect we'll come back to discussing costs a bit later on in this discussion.
Right. In fact, I'd like to turn to Ellen Collins now, because Ellen, the Research Information Network has been really instrumental in helping to drive attention around this particular subject. There was a report released about a year ago, the so-called Finch Report. You were involved in developing that. You'll be looking at what's been happening in the year since very soon, and would like to hear about that. But again, in the news this past summer was reports of a committee in the UK Parliament that took a hard look at all this and asked some questions. And can you summarize what they had to say and what your thoughts are on their point of view?
Gladly. You're right. Yes, there's been a lot of interest around this in government, starting with the Finch Review. This time last year, there was subsequently an examination by a committee in the House of Lords, and then the one that you mentioned, which is a committee of the House of Commons. And those are two quite different groups of people. The Commons are elected, so they do have a slightly more political dimension to how they see a lot of this.
And in fact, the committee chairman is from the Labour Party, which is
correct.
In opposition right now.
He is
now.
From the opposition. So, you know, it's a scrutiny and oversight mechanism for the UK government, but we also have to remember that there are some political motivations within this report. So, yes, The BIS committee report suggested that perhaps the original policy based on the government policy based on the Finch Review was flawed in several ways, that it had failed to take into account certain aspects to do with the finances of the transition, that it was putting pressure on certain parts of the system that maybe couldn't deal with that pressure yet.
Well, can you talk about that? Because I think that's the point I wanted to make, sort of coming from where Robert was discussing around the cost of OA. What that particular committee was saying was that the gold route, the gold road, was more costly than the UK could afford. Can you explain that?
Well, there is a sense that the with article processing charge levels at the level that they're at the moment, that it's not a sustainable option for universities to be funding the costs of these, underwriting the costs for publishers of this open access option, which is quite difficult because actually the data that we have right now on the transition and on the costs is not great. We don't have a lot of information about what's happening, and it's almost a little bit too early to say for sure it is working or it isn't working. And I think that's partly a problem with the report. You know, it took a very different view from the Finch report, and that's good. It's important that we have a diversity of views out there. But equally, it may be precipitate to say, you know, we need to scrap this, we need to rethink it, there's all these problems with it. There are problems with the implementation, but we knew there would be. And so really it's a question of making sure we stay on top of understanding those.
Right, so there was some concern in the press in the UK and elsewhere then that going out on this golden road was kind of going out on a golden limb too, right?
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it, and it's true. And that is widely recognised. I mean, that was known by the government when they made this policy, that they were sort of putting themselves out there, and in a way, I think they felt almost a responsibility to do that, to take a leadership role. And they have been leading discussions internationally about how we're going to, you know, move corporately.
Sure, Robert.
Can I just, I mean, I completely agree with what Ellen's saying, that the UK is clearly leading the way here. But I think it is a misnomer to assume that only UK are paying article processing charges. So just two pieces of data. I looked at, simply because it starts with A, I looked at the American Chemical Society, and they have an open access option, and all their open access articles get put into PubMed Central, so very easy to find this stuff is. Anyone can replicate it. 25% of every article which had been routed through that system, i.e. a fee had been paid of $3,000 or whatever, was published by NIH. So, you know, NIH is perceived as a green funder, no mandate to pay APCs. 25% of APC of ACS articles, which went through that gold route, were met by NIH. If you look at a slightly bigger player, PLOS, we see that 20%, just in PLOS One alone, over 20% of PLOS One articles were NIH funded. So I agree completely, UK are leading the way, but we are not on our own.
Well, that's absolutely fair, and we should point out that there are two places where that's happening in the U.S. Earlier this year, the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the U.S., OSTP, said that they want to see, to the greatest extent and with the least constraints, access to federally funded research be made as open as possible. So there was that sort of beginning of a policy. It's still to be formed, as I understand it. And among U.S. publishers, there's something known as CORUS, the Clearinghouse for the Open Research of the United States, and this is an internal U.S. effort to create repositories around that. So we don't want to make it sound as if this is really U.K. only.
Absolutely. Very much
it's a global phenomenon.
And in Europe as well. Any research that's funded through the next round of European funding, Horizon 2020, will be expected to be published in open access. And again, as you're saying, people are still finding their way about what that actually means in terms of the business models, but there is a commitment to the principle.
Right. Well, I wanted to start this way because I think it's really fair to the audience for them to hear exactly what's been going on, but to also understand that while they might read a headline, not a lot is going to change, probably.
No.
And Ellen, talk about that.
Well, the UK government is committed to this policy, and there has been a review recently looking at how we've progressed over the first year, and that review finds significant progress and considers that progress is due to the impetus from the Finch Group and the Finch Report that really put a bomb under the movement that had been sort of bubbling along for a while, but it said, no, this is something we are committed to. It also finds this issue that you've just mentioned, that the UK is doing a good job of making its research open to the rest of the world, but there is still an issue around the rest of the world's research being open to the UK. When the UK is moving faster, it's not gaining the benefit necessarily because other countries are not moving at the same speed, so that research remains behind a subscription paywall. And so there needs to be some work looking at how we can sort of resolve that issue for UK researchers to make sure that they're not sort of going out there, putting their research out there, but not being able to get the content that they need from their colleagues internationally.
Right, well, that seems reasonable, but to put it on a bumper sticker, as I say back home, the gold road is not going away.
Oh, no, it's not going away in the UK for sure.
And Robert, you would agree.
Absolutely.
And you're going to insist on it, in fact.
Well, what we do is we don't actually insist on gold because there are some publishers, Nature Publishing Group, their flagship journal, AAAS for their flagship journal. You can't pay. You can't give them any money you like. There is no gold option. So when our authors publish there, then the green option is the only way they can go. So that is permissible. But if there's a choice between having your article made available at the day of publication in our repository with a full reuse license versus some other option where the author has to faff around doing stuff, the embargo period after so many months, the license at best unclear, probably not there at all, we clearly favour the first option and recognise that we'll pay those costs. But I do repeat that we need to look at those costs and need to try and do what we can to make this gold open access market far more functional than it is at the moment.
Well, that's a point we're going to come back to about how to make it functional. But I want to turn to Karen Hawkins from the United States. So you hear about some of these UK issues, and you probably have to follow them very closely at IEEE. And I want to ask you about your response to all of this. At the IEEE, you're a society, a membership-driven organization. So really, you're there to serve your authors. How is the open access movement making it easier or more difficult to do that?
Well, so first I want to make clear that although we are based in the U.S., we are very much an international organization. More than half of our membership is based outside the U.S., and so we do have to monitor trends in the U.S., in the EU, in the U.K. We are a member association, so we are member and volunteer-led. We are also working in the fields of electrical engineering and computing and related technologies. So our members and our authors are the ones who initially have pushed for OA, and our job is to accommodate them. So we are offering three open access options at the IEEE. In the past year, we launched a fully open access gold online-only mega journal in all of IEEE's fields of interest, and that's called IEEE Access. We have four other more focused, narrowly topical, fully gold open access journals, and we offer a hybrid option in all of our existing journals that originated under a subscription model. We expect to be doing more open access publishing. We have three new gold journals up for approval at our next board meeting next month. So we're offering a range.
Well, it's interesting to see that. And yet to ask you about open access is probably to open a very confusing set of terms, right? What do we mean by open? What do we mean by access? And I'm sure your members have all sorts of definitions for that.
So that is a challenge for us. You know, the as a lifelong publisher and someone who's committed to disseminating information, and as someone who works with an organization that has disseminating information as a huge focus, we're very much supportive of the concept. The challenge comes from the diversity of approaches from different governments, different funders. You know, as a nonprofit, our resources go back into the educational activities of our organization. So we don't have a big profit margin that we could exploit to address some of the changes in a nimble way. And we're trying very hard to keep up with the changes and the recommendations. We are participating in the Chorus Initiative. We're participating in the pilot. You know, we have established institutional deposit accounts to accommodate institutions that want to take that approach to paying to open access. But just managing the diversity of details that come from the different initiatives is a challenge for us.
Right. As you say, there's a diversity of details, and really that provokes a need for the kind of conversation we're having right now, to provide
Absolutely.
Information for people to come to some kind of consensus around these issues. But that's probably a little ways off for IEEE if you've got all these different models.
Well, I think it's a little way off for all of us, frankly. I think, you know, there are a lot of experiments going on now. Some of them are going to work very well. Some of them are going to work less well. I think, you know, I was at the Open Access Scholarly Publishing Conference recently. There was a lot of discussion there about establishing standards for metadata and ways of communicating about licenses. All of those things would really help us as a publisher.
And standards for making the article processing charge work more efficiently within the workflow for you as well as for the customer, the librarians, and others, I would imagine.
You know, that standards in systems would help if it were easier to communicate about things like the acceptance of an open access article and, you know, APCs being paid. But standards across the board, I think, in terms of reuse rights for articles, for example, there's a lot of diversity there, too, that needs to be managed.
Right. Well, Rob Johnson, if I could turn to you for the university perspective, just recently with the University of Nottingham, now consulting with universities and others around these issues, what is the challenge for the university in a nutshell? Is it about who should handle the funds?
I think there's multiple challenges just at the moment. I was at a workshop just a couple of days ago with a number of university administrators who are tasked with implementing these funder mandates. And actually, we talked about exactly that question, and people shared what they felt the biggest challenge was. And really, I think the largest one at this stage is cultural. And it's about what you tend to have is librarians who are absolutely bought into the concept of open access. And then you have a huge variation between disciplines. So when you look at biomedical sciences, I think because of the efforts of Wellcome and because of NIH, there's much greater awareness and adoption of open access. But some of the other disciplinary areas, it's a really hard sell at this stage to enable people to understand what open access means, what the benefits are, why they should do it, and actually how they should do it. So I think I've had a lot of conversations with academics who said, well, I had a go, and it was just too difficult, so I gave up. And that comes back to a lot of this increasing standardization, commonality of metadata. So it's cultural. I think it's also people often don't realize how difficult it is for a university to know what's going on, because universities are very disparate organizations. And so you have people in the role of the librarian, the research manager, and they don't necessarily know how much of their organization's output is actually open access. So when funders say they want it to be 100% OA or 75%, we don't always know where we're starting from, and getting hold of that information is a real challenge.
Well, back to some numbers, if I could, Rob. So you've seen the growth of open access. There are obviously different routes. We've spoken about that. But can you point to some directions early on?
Well, there's been, I think as Robert said, there's been all sorts of different studies and so on in this area. I mean, there was a very interesting study from Science Metrics commissioned by the EC that felt that OA had reached a tipping point, and that in a number of countries and a number of disciplines, more than 50% of articles were now open access. I have to say that came as a surprise to me, because that didn't really chime with my own experience talking to authors, talking to universities. So other studies have suggested it's more in the 20-30% range, and that's closer to my sense. So at Nottingham, we found we'd probably gone up to about 10% gold open access, and I would be honest and say actually we didn't know quite how much was green. We knew perhaps what was in our institutional repository. It was very hard to track what was sitting elsewhere in subject repositories, whether it was all legitimately made available or whether there were the PDFs out there that really shouldn't be. So the sense is perhaps another 30% or so in the green the green route, but it's very hard to say.
And is it too hard to say whether gold is coming up on the inside and perhaps about to take over?
I think where we are at the moment is green is more widespread, but gold is growing faster, and a lot of that is driven by the funders, and that's certainly what we'd seen at Nottingham. So gold, we'd had an open access fund for a number of years, but we really saw the level of interest and number of people trying to access that fund grow. Whether or not they were actually funded, so what we have seen is just the level of interest and awareness has gone up. There's still huge challenges. A lot of people, it still hasn't really permeated through. But because we're starting from a low base, we were looking at a kind of doubling in the level of interest earlier this year from 1 year previously.
Right. And for the academic community, are they feeling caught in the middle, if you will? They're sort of at the point, at the sharp point of funders, authors, publishers, who are all trying to come up with solutions that they really have to make it work.
That's right, and so they often look to administrators to make their lives easier and to provide guidance, and that's a real challenge. So as I say, a lot of the challenge is making it easy for authors to comply. So in many cases, it's very rare that you find an academic who doesn't agree with the principle of open access, but it's when they've got students to teach, they've got actual research to do, they're supposed to be engaging with industry, it's another thing for them to do, and if it takes more than 5 minutes, then that's often enough to turn them off.
And that would turn off the librarians and the administrators as well, presumably.
Yeah, well, I think for the librarians and the administrators, all of this has been, in many ways, additional work. So many universities are struggling to find the resources and to channel the effort into it that is necessary. So many people, you talk to people and their inboxes are overflowing with queries from academics. And so very much universities are gearing up to try and handle this. But I think much like the publishers and every other stakeholder, it's rapidly changing, and organizations and systems and standards take a little while to catch up.
Robert Kiley, we've heard a lot about what you expect of researchers at Wellcome Trust. What do you expect of publishers?
We expect, so when we're paying an article processing charge, we expect publishers to provide a first-class service. So that means making our articles available in our repository, PubMed Central, Europe PubMed Central, at time of publication. It means making clear that what license is attached to that, and putting that license information in a machine-readable way in the obvious part of the XML, not hiding it somewhere at the bottom of a paper. It means being very clear what the costs are. So a whole raft of services, but we're paying for, and we know that from our experience of doing this for 8 or 10 years or however long it is, it feels a lifetime. I've gone grey in the time I've been doing this. It feels to me that publishers really have to up their game, provide a first-class service for our researchers, because we know that when we want content in our repository, the surest way of getting it in there is for the publisher to do it. With one very, very small data point I'll show you. We were doing some, we do what we call an assessment framework each year at the Trust. We look to see which papers are sort of have created the most impact, or impact factor, which papers are the, have caused the most stir, have generated the most interest, have been cited most. And it was really pleasing to see that about 90-odd percent of these articles were in our open. It's only a relatively small cohort, 30 or 50 papers, or most of them were in our repository. There were three or four which weren't, and they were from Nature, Science, and New England Journal of Medicine. Three massive, massive journals. You would think if you got an article published there, you would, you know, you'd be cock-a-hoop. All those three journals, none of them have a gold option, so it's up to the author invariably to actually do something. And in that case, the author hadn't done it. Why hadn't the author done it? Because by the time they've published the paper, you know, they've got it finally accepted, they're moving on. The effort of then going back to start worrying about when they can deposit it, what embargo periods have to set, quite frankly, I suspect for most, it's a bit of a faff and not really worth the candle.
Well, Karen Hawkins, you heard some of that, and you know, I know the challenge for the business end of IEEE is keeping up with all of that and meeting those expectations, right? And some of them are about the metadata and being able to have identifiers for these articles so that people do know that it's open access. That's a critical point, I would imagine.
So that is important. I would come back to your point. I mean, what IEEE has done historically is, first, we have always had a generous author posting policy. Authors are able to post the accepted version of their paper upon publication. And, you know, you spoke about the author not having clarity about what they can post or when, but what we do with journal papers that come through our systems is we actually push a message to the author, and we say, your authorized version for posting is available now, you know, click this link, come get the paper, and you can post it as needed. So that's one thing that we have done for quite a while, and again, with the diversity, you know, different authors are mandated to post in different places. So we have, you know, we very much tried to address that, and we are trying to monitor the other requirements and address them as well.
But I think you told me about an OASPA survey that said that something like more than half of open access articles don't have the appropriate DOI.
We did talk about that. You know, the other thing that came up before was the definition of first-class service. And as a publisher, I see components of that that are a bit different. You know, to us, first-class service would include additional things beyond what you mentioned. Did I do that? I would start with things like very high-quality peer review, copy editing of the paper, supporting the author, giving the author a good experience throughout the process. But we also do things like obtain DOIs for all of our papers. I think that's what you were mentioning. At the OASPA conference, someone did mention that in a survey of open access journals, and again, this was across all publishers, across all disciplines, more than half were not obtaining DOIs. And DOIs, of course, are useful to discoverability. The other thing that surprised me about that survey was that a lot of the open access publishers, I believe, again, more than half, self-reported that they did not have a long-term archiving arrangement with a third party. So in other words, if that publisher went out of business, their website could disappear and that content would be lost. So we do, as a publisher, you know, we have a commitment to keeping our content available no matter what happens to us. And it costs us money to do that each year. So that's all part of what we see as providing first-class service in a sustainable way, is being able to obtain DOIs, provide archiving, provide high-quality peer review. and to make the author's content as discoverable as possible so that it can be used and the community can benefit from it.
And also can be compliant with the requirements and the mandates of someone like the Wellcome Trust.
Yep.
Ellen Collins, the Research Information Network last fall published a report looking at the role of intermediaries in all of this to try to make this work and kind of smooth out the edges. Talk about that report and what some of its key conclusions were.
Sure. So we did a study which was actually funded by the Wellcome Trust, among others. This was right after RCUK made its policy announcement that it was going to be implementing this decision, you have to go gold, or, well, we will support you to go gold. And it was quite clear that this is going to be a step change for both universities and for publishers in terms of how they manage their income streams and their outgoings. When you think about, as an author, you're in an institution, you might want to publish with a number of publishers, and each publisher has a number of institutions working with them. Everybody has their own systems, and they're slightly different, and they don't always talk to each other very effectively. Equally, if you're somebody in Rob's kind of role, you don't want to be submitting invoices to 20 different publishers and dealing with each one of those separately and collecting data about, you know, the level of the expenditure that you've got on this package of open access activity. So there's a very obvious role for somebody to sit between all of these universities on the one hand and all of these publishers on the other hand and just smooth that payment process and make it really straightforward. And the report suggested that this is a service that would be very welcome on both sides. And it also found that there is perhaps an opportunity not just to be a very technical, functional type of organization, but actually to be supporting information flow back and forth, so being able to tell institutions, you know, as Rob said, they find it really difficult to monitor the level of expenditure, you know, how many of their articles are being produced in this format that's now required in this open access format. Having a central repository of information that, because they've processed all of these payments, knows exactly how much you, the University of Nottingham or whoever, have spent, exactly how many articles have been published, and then being able to provide that to report back to the funders like Wellcome and RCUK, that's a really asset, it's a really valuable asset. On both sides, you know, it's a useful service.
And there's a bit of a chicken and egg there, isn't there, Robert? You know, you need those kinds of reports to get the compliance, but you need the compliance to get the kind of information you need. But you would like to see fundamentally a process that does sort of streamline that workflow.
I think we're looking for efficiencies in the system, and clearly there are roles for some middleware, which I think what the intermediaries are. I think we also, though, have to... What I wouldn't want to lose in this process is one of the key benefits of open access is around transparency. When authors know if they're publishing at PLOS One is X, if they're publishing at Cell Press it's Y. And I think it's important that authors do know what publishers are charging. So I really believe intermediaries have a role to play, but I wouldn't want that to be at the risk of divorcing researchers from an awareness of price.
Okay. And Rob Johnson, finally, before we go to some questions from the audience, the librarians also are looking for intermediaries because they want to be able to have as light a touch on all this as possible, right?
That's right. I mean, at the moment, this is a very labor-intensive process for authors and for librarians and administrators in universities. And you know, you go and talk to people, and really what they've got is one huge spreadsheet or multiple huge spreadsheets trying to keep track of all of this stuff. And then at the end of the year, trying to amalgamate all of that and going back to authors and saying, oh, this article you published, who was it funded by? Was it a Wellcome article? Was it RCUK? Was it someone else? And that is just taking a huge amount of time. It's very inefficient. It's the lack of standardization in approaches. So, yeah, people are crying out for greater standardization, greater consistency of approach.
And management tools to handle all
absolutely,
of that.
Yeah. So being able to source that information that at the moment people are going and getting by sending an email or talking to people, actually having recognized fields, consistency, you know, DOIs, things like FundRef, all of those institutional identifiers, funder identifiers, and being able to use those to actually aggregate that data automatically is going to save a huge amount of time.
Great. Well, now is the opportunity for the audience to ask some questions, and I can't imagine that this kind of a crowd doesn't have a lot to ask of our panelists. So I'm going to come to you with the microphone. If you could raise your hand when you do speak, if you'd let us know who you are and where you're from, that would be terrific. So who wants to start? We have somebody in the front row. Okay. I'll hang on to the microphone, sir. You are?
Sorry, I'm Anthony Watkins in Cyber Research. Okay, should I speak?
Yes, please. What's your question and who's it for?
It's mainly for Robert, but mandates originally seen by many people like Robert as being educational, yeah? And the problem is that educational doesn't seem to work. And one does find that the academics are very slow to recognize open access, partly because of the scam ones. That's what they mention anyhow all the time. Now, we all know that there are lots of very good open access journals which have the quality of peer review and so on. But how on earth do you avoid having to really enforce? Because academics are very unhappy about being enforced.
Well, and academics have other things to do than worry about mandates, or at least they did up until very recently. So it must be a hard transition for them.
Yes, I agree, Anthony. It is difficult. I think we've always... It's almost like a Faustian deal, if you like, though, isn't it? If you come to the welcome and you accept our funding, in return for that, we expect you to do certain things. Like make your work open access and so forth. Obviously, the scam we saw last week, I think it really doesn't help open access, but I think we should put it in context. All the really credible high-volume open access publishers, the PLOS, the Biomed Central, Hindawis, they all spotted this, and it's a very, very small number of rogue publishers, but there are rogues in this world, and there are rogues in publishing, and just as there are rogues in banking and any other field.
Well, there's no rogues here in this audience, I'm sure of that. Don't identify yourself, even if you are. Shirley, just a moment, Anthony.
I agree entirely with what Robert said, but unfortunately, and I've been interviewing academics, not on this particular point, on trust, but this came up. Every day, an academic gets a request for putting a paper or becoming an editorial board member or even editor. I get them, and I'm only a peripheral academic. Now, that's the problem. It's not the fact that there's so few of them, and it's no point... I mean, I've talked to other friends of yours, Cameron Naylor and so on. Something has to be done about it because destroying the possibilities.
Well, Karen Hawkins, what about that? I'm sure that when you get together with other publishers, you talk about some of these issues and you may be speaking about some of these very points. How do you feel?
So, you know, what we hear from our authors is that some of what you're talking about is one of the unintended consequences, obviously, of open access. But it is a challenge. You know, one of the unintended consequences that we have seen is papers that were intended to be published in a specific journal. You know, if they're published with a CC BY license, then can appear in other places that authors did not want them to show up. And another thing that historically the publishers have done on behalf of authors is protect their interest in the intellectual property. In a gold open access environment with CC BY license, that changes a little bit. We no longer have legal standing to do that. And frankly, our authors are concerned about that. We have also seen our volunteers come and say, somebody's listing my name as an editor on this journal. I don't know who they are. So that is something that I think we as a community have to manage if we're going to maintain the quality that we all would like to see.
Yeah, Karen, a great point because, excuse me, it's about that relationship. It's about their relationship with your authors, and it's about customer service to them. You've been providing certain kinds of service that they expect and no longer will be able to enjoy. I'd like to take another question from the all the way over there. Just a second. So, yes, sir, you are.
I'm Brian Scanlon from Tima Publishers. I just have a question. If one is a large American Society publisher and one takes all of the articles in a given year and multiplies by $3,000, you'll probably come up with maybe, I have no idea, 10, 20, 30% of the subscription revenue coming in from those journals. So if they all went open access, how would they fund the rest of their society activities, which they have traditionally relied upon their publications program to fund?
Well, Karen, that's obviously a question you can start with. It's got to be a real challenge.
If I knew the answer to that, I'd be in really fabulous shape. It is a challenge for particularly societies. You know, we've been around for over 125 years, and we have been creating communities of scientists and technical experts. They create new journals, new conferences, continuing education courses. We really facilitate the process of science and scholarship. And when there is what we call a surplus, if anything falls out of a subscription beyond what it takes to maintain the subscription in a society like ours, in a nonprofit, that surplus goes to those activities of starting a new journal in an emerging technology, for example. And it is going to be a challenge. I do think that as the technology evolves, you know, we can look toward managing some of the costs of publishing. Unfortunately, in the short term, some of the complexity of Gold OA, I think, is actually pushing things in the other direction. But I am optimistic that, you know, we'll be able to converge on standards and processes that will make this manageable. We've been doing it for 125 years. We can keep doing it.
Can I add, Chris?
Sure, please, Ellen. Yes.
It's really encouraging to hear that from a society publisher, because certainly in the UK, when the Finch Review was originally published, there was a big concern among particularly some of the smaller society publishers that this was going to completely undermine the business model that they rely on to do the disciplinary support work, and in some cases, particularly in humanities and social science disciplines, crucial to the long-term functioning of that discipline. They are the primary funders of early career researchers in terms of helping them to get to conferences, to get their work into the academic system that will eventually employ them and allow them to rise through the ranks. That's something that is now being looked at. You know, how is this policy direction from the UK going to affect learned societies? But I think, you know, Karen is right that these societies have survived for many, many years, and it's a question of adapting and thinking about new opportunities and new ways that you perhaps can be supporting your members, you know, in an open access world where there's masses of content. Maybe there's a new service that you need to provide that's about filtration and identifying the key things you need to read. So there are opportunities, but it is a big change. And
I'm sorry, Robert.
I was going to say, just let me support that, but I think rather than a lot of hand-wringing, there's also work learned societies can do. There was a survey published only a couple of weeks ago by ALPSP, and if Audra's here, she can correct me on the data, but I think it said something like 25% of learned societies have no open access option at all, not even what I would consider completely risk-free hybrid option. So I think we do need to do some work to make sure learned societies are a key part of the publishing ecosystem. But just putting your hands, you know, keeping your head down, hope it's going to go away, I think that's a flawed approach.
Right, and it seems to me here at Frankfurt Book Fair, the words are innovation and adaptation, and they really are common throughout this particular hall here, the scientific and technical hall, but throughout the whole fair.
Before you go on, I wanted to say, too, as a society publisher, the Gold Road, I can see how that could work. I think what is more frightening for society publishers is a green approach with a very brief embargo. And I know I have heard open access advocates say, the green is not a problem with a short embargo. You know, it's going to all work out. But when we look at our usage statistics and the information that is used the most, it's very hard to see how a purely green approach with a short embargo would not be damaging to society publishers and others.
Yeah.
Okay, good point. Yes, you had a question, I think?
Marcus Kalina with Pulses Publishing. I am wondering, and this is going back to how do we assure quality in publishing, with the proliferance of open access, how do you assure quality? How do you sift out bogus articles like it came up last week? Does that necessarily, in your mind, mean that open access will forever be married to a peer review process? Or is there something beyond peer review that you can see in the future?
beyond peer review. I'm not sure what that could be. Yeah. But Ellen Collins, it seemed to me that that story last week, the sting, the scam, whatever you want to call it, really was much more a story about peer review than it was a story about open access.
I'd agree. And I think one flaw that most people who've commented on this study have identified is that there's no control group, right? We're not all scientists. I'm not a scientist. But I do know, as a social scientist, if you're going to make an assertion that something is a consequence of something else, you need to have a control group to understand whether it's about the thing you're talking about, whether there's some other factors. Now, I don't know enough about what the methodology of this study, but my feeling is that there would be subscription publishers out there that are not running peer review at the standard we would want. And I think it's slightly unfortunate for open access that it does seem to have this connection or perception that it's not about peer review. And that's clearly not the case. Open access content is, as a rule, subject to exactly the same peer review process. The only difference is that for some of the mega journals, they review for just for scientific quality rather than for both quality and relevance or significance. And I think, you know, I think peer review is evolving, and you are beginning to see, you know, new models of peer review. There are services now that will review your article before it's submitted to a journal, and the option for journals to use those reviews in their own analysis and attempt to kind of streamline the process. There's all kinds of innovations around that, but I don't think we should necessarily tie that to open access. It's a separate issue, and it's dangerous to conflate the two.
Right. And the point that I would make, and Rob Johnson, help me out with this, is that quality is of a concern to authors, to publishers, and to the academics and the librarians that you work with.
Very much so. So picking up on the first part of your question, that was something we grappled with at a university level. So how do you make sure when someone is paying an article processing charge, it is to a legitimate journal? And there are several different approaches to that. So there's always a tension between this concept of academic freedom and giving authors the ability to publish where they want and maintaining some oversight. And so some universities or some departments would actually come up with a list of journals and say, these are the ones where we're prepared to pay an APC and only these. Others would say, you know, and this is rather dubious, but only those above a certain impact factor. Others would almost assess it on a case-by-case basis, because what you'd often find is it was the early career researchers, it was the more junior lecturers who would get sucked in by some of these approaches. Yeah. And so what many institutions would do is build in a review by a more senior academic who's more likely to recognize which are the legitimate journals that it's worth publishing in.
And of course, the problem is you don't want to discourage new market entrants. You don't want to say that because you're a new journal without an impact factor, without a long history, without, you know, the marks of quality that maybe you would look at, you can't publish with this journal. That's important that new journals and new business models continue to be possible, but it is a very delicate balance.
It is, and some institutions have found they've actually put too many barriers in the way, and then they're not getting the levels of compliance with the funder mandate, so it's a really difficult balance to strike.
Yeah. Well, we know that new journals should be welcomed because eLife is there and it's not even a year old. Well, we have more questions from the audience here. Anyone else here would like to ask a question of our panel? Yes, I'll come around to you just a sec. Yes, please. What's your question? What's your name first?
My name's Kim. I'm from Emerald Group Publishing. I was interested in Ellen's introduction. You mentioned that you were looking at open access for monographs, and we're a social sciences publisher. I wonder if you could shed some light on what the challenges are for open access for a books market in comparison to a journals market and where you see that heading.
Oh, boy. How long
actually,
have we got?
Ellen, before you answer, Robert, I believe the Wellcome Trust has issued a policy around monographs just recently. You can tell us about that.
Yeah, so as of about 10 days ago, October the 1st, Wellcome Trust grant holders are now, the mandate now, it covers both journal articles, which is done for 10 years or so, and now it covers monographs, and also book chapters. So basically any research output which has got a Wellcome Trust name on it is expected to be open access.
So it's a timely question, but go ahead, Ellen.
Well, yeah, monographs are an interesting area, actually, because whereas, as Robert said, you know, Wellcome Trust has had a policy for over, well, coming up for 10 years on journal articles, there are reasonably well-established pockets of academia where the culture is, yes, open access, I understand how to do that. There are good quality journals for me to publish in. There's money available for me to pay for it. You know, it's not solved, but this model is ticking along. With books, completely new. I mean, we're talking about disciplines, apart from medical humanities, which is sort of Robert's area of interest. Many disciplines where open access is viewed, if not with hostility, with suspicion. And, you know, people who feel very differently about books than they do about journal articles. A book is the expression of many, many years of work, and it's something that takes a long time to write. And working on these subjects, you know, academics do feel very attached to their books, and they really want that to be with a publisher that the publisher is so important to them. So what we're seeing with books is a lot of interest, some developing models, lots of different models. There's the models that look at a sort of subsidy by the funder. So the funder pays a sum of money in the same way that they do for an article, and that covers the cost of producing the book, which is then available in open access. There are models where libraries club together and pay to sort of unlock the book, so it's available in open access immediately on publication. There are models where a new publisher will start up, and because their system costs and the systems that they build are designed purely for electronic publishing and open access, their costs are very low, so that then means they can afford to make content open access at a very easy to reach level for authors, or relatively easy to reach. And there are some really crazy models out there that are kind of saying, you know, let's just do it with altruism, let's get people to crowdsource to pay the cost of making something open access. So I would say, you know, it's not figured out at all. It's anybody's game at the moment, but there's a lot of really interesting things out there and an appetite for it. You know, there are researchers, they are small in number, but they tend to be people who are quite engaged and interested. So there are researchers who are trying to push this agenda in the humanities and social sciences for monographs. So I'd be really surprised if in 10 years' time we weren't here having a conversation that looks quite different.
It's probably going to happen a lot faster than that as well, Ellen.
We hope, you would hope. But it's hard for publishers because, you know, it's a very different business model. Their systems are not always set up. You know, even something as simple as the principle in journals that you don't ask about open access until it's been accepted. Well, for a publisher, that book, the time between saying the book will happen or, you know, we want to maybe publish a book and actually publishing it, you start selling that book before the author's finished writing it in many cases. So how do you know if you're selling an open access book by accident? And then what do you do if it turns out the author does want to make it open access and you've already sold 100 copies? How do you deal with that? So there are some specific issues that are quite challenging for publishers to adapt to.
Right. Well, Karen Hawkins, I see you vigorously nodding your head. You're already imagining even more problems to deal with, I think.
You know, it's not that I imagine more. It's that, you know, what I'm sitting here thinking is, ironically, the more successful you have been as a publisher in the past, the more legacy systems you have. And, you know, as you're pointing out, it's sometimes easier to start from scratch than like turn around the barge that, you know, has been structured to support the other model.
Yeah. And I think, again, that's somewhere that intermediaries can play a really important role. It's kind of smoothing some of those difficulties around the transition process.
Right. We have time for one more question from the audience. Is there a final question here? Well, I hope you will stay around. We've got some more time here in this space. I want to thank our panelists, Robert Kiley, Ellen Collins, Karen Hawkins, Rob Johnson. Please give them a warm round of applause. I want to add to my little story about Professor Scheckman there at the University of California at Berkeley. A Nobel Prize laureate gets to receive a diploma, a medal, and a cash prize. But when you're at UCal Berkeley, you also get a reserved parking space in the faculty lot, which is worth even more. For more information about Copyright Clearance Center and Open Access, go to copyright.com/open access. I'm Christopher Keneally. Have a great day and a great Frankfurt Book Fair.